You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish and I am joined today by half man, half machine. His name is Abby.
I was going to call you the tech king of the north.
We had a spirited debate about AI before we started this. It's very timely because actually I just got involved with AI for the first time. I had my microchip
installed. So your new girlfriend? She just arrived. Amazon That's delivered
good.
Her.
That's good. That's
you
good.
Got your microchip installed?
You have to wow. charge it up first, yeah. The girlfriend, not the microchip.
Do you find you have better reception?
Oh, that's good. No, I just got my first vaccine shot actually on Friday.
Nice, nice. Well, that's why I was asking, do you find you have better cell phone reception
now? Like, I didn't get that. Pretty good. I like that. Actually, I saw Bill and Melinda Gates just split up.
Nice. Yeah, I saw that on Instagram actually today.
Yeah. I guess they want to, like, he's going to take the half of the world that he microchipped. She's going to take the half of the world that she microchipped.
Nice. I just slid in her DM. I sent her a message.
I was going to say,
Melinda,
you picked a bad time to get into a relationship. You got work to do.
What was Jeff Bezos' wife? His name was.
I don't remember, but they split. They split up too.
Yeah, all these tech billionaires. Jeez.
I know, man. Life is tough. One day that'll be you.
$65 billion he has after the split up or something. It's pocket change nowadays.
Okay.
Yeah,
he'll be okay. How you doing?
Oh man, I'm doing pretty well.
It's nice to do something like live in person.
Yeah, we are. We're back in the studio, our makeshift home studio.
Abby's condominium.
Yeah, exactly.
So today we're going to be talking about how not to lose money, right? How to invest defensively, specifically in cannabis. And before we were chatting, and you said something really good about investing defensively.
Mm-hmm. And it's not how to lose money. It's how to not lose as much money.
Right. You missed the word "not" at the beginning. So it's not how not to lose money. It's how not to lose
as much money. Yeah.
Right.
So defensive investing, you'll still have losses, but they'll just be mitigated.
Right.
They won't be as bad as, let's say, the market collapses 40%, which, you know, since the February highs up until now in cannabis, we are down about that
Something
much.
Like that. Yep.
So if you're only down 10%, you've actually outperformed the market by 30%.
Right.
Right. So that's a defensive strategy. You're still down 10%.
Right.
You're not as, it could be way worse.
Right. It's relative performance, basically. Right. And this is something that a lot of newer investors don't understand. In fact, like
a lot of seasoned investors don't understand.
a lot of financial advisors have this problem when the market's down.
Yeah.
And they talk to their clients and they say, look, like the market's down 20%. You're only down 10%.
Yeah.
You know, you should feel good about that.
Yeah.
And the client just hears like excuses. Like they say, well, I'm still down 10%. So like, why do I pay you? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that relative performance actually that's a real thing. I mean, that's
for sure
exceptional to be able to do that. Right. Another way to look at it is that if you bought something that only went down 10%, everything else goes down 20%. Mm-hmm. Well, you can theoretically, you know, reallocate. You can sell and move into the thing that's gone down more, right?
If it makes sense,
yeah. Right? But that's sort of the advantage of of that.
This is also a good barometer for passive versus active investing, right? You and I were chatting about Buffett and Munger earlier, and passive investing will make, you know, if you just buy the market goes down by 40%. You are going to go down 40%. That's passive investing.
Right.
You pay for an active manager to sort of outperform the market, right? And so that management fee that you're paying is for that. Now, let's say, you know, if you have an active manager, the market's down 40%, you're down 50%. That's a different story.
Well, and this is actually, you know, Buffett's classic point is that it's not that most people are bad money managers. It's just that, you know, the fees they pay themselves to justify what they're doing makes it very hard for them to outperform because if the, you know, the market averages 7% and your, you know, investment manager manages, you know, manages to hit 10%,
right? That's actually the difference between, you know, 7% and 10%, you know, those 3 points. I think that's like, you know, 40% extra performance from 7 to 10, right?
Yeah.
But then if they take a 2-point fee, right, then that kind of brings it back to, you know, 8 versus 7. So it's like it's very hard for them to consistently outperform, right? Especially when they're charging the fees.
Yeah.
You know, it weighs.
You got to bake that into the returns.
Exactly. Too. Right. Yeah. So the point being here is that, you know, I've mentioned this as the market was kind of going a little crazy. I was saying to people, look, I'm getting more defensive, but we didn't necessarily explain what that actually meant. Right. And I think now's a very good time because it feels like we're sort of at this transitional period where, you know, some people think that we're about to be on the next leg up for cannabis. Some people think we're about to be on the next leg down for cannabis, right? I personally don't know which one it is in the short term. I have no idea what happens in the short term, but I just wanted to share some ideas about how to think about investing. Because what I've noticed is when things are going up, like especially hyperbolically up, people only look up to the sky and say, how much money can we make?
Yeah. People always think that things can always go higher.
When they're going up, right? When things are going up 10% a day, all anybody wants to do is like say, okay, well, we can go 3 or 5x from here, right? But when things are going down, it's a complete opposite.
Yeah, people want to sell right away.
People look at like, okay, like, where's the bottom? And someone says the bottom is zero. And they go, well, oh my God, what happens if this goes to zero, right? But the point is that when you're investing, you need to keep these two things in your mind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You always need to be thinking, you know, what is the upside here and what is the downside here, right? Understanding that just because you think the upside is $2 and the downside is 50 cents, the stock can go higher or lower than that, you know, as it wishes.
Yeah.
But if you have some way of understanding sort of, you know, core value, and this is, again, this later about the thesis, but if you have a way of actually understanding kind of how you value the stock or having risk mitigation strategies, then that can really help you in both scenarios, when things are going up and when things are going down.
Or the most important thing that I always say on this thing, on this podcast, is sell discipline. You need to have sell discipline, whether you're defensively investing or offensively investing. If usually when you enter a stock or a company, you should know what your exit price is, right? And it's tough to gauge. And, you know, I always say, like, just because people say, well, what do you do when it hits your exit price? Well, when it starts getting close to your exit price, you ask yourself what's fundamentally changed or what's different about the business.
Right.
If it's approaching your exit price, let's say you enter a stock at $10 and it just starts going parabolic, all of a sudden, you know, it's a 10% increase day over day, volume has spiked up, that's a good time to sell, right?
Well, so we're going to get into this, right? And this is that we have kind of different ways of looking at the market, right? But this is very important, is that there's not one right answer. And we were talking about this in the context of, you know, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and that, you know, when you look at how they invest, I think it's sort of more apparent than ever before that, look, these guys are, you know, from a different era. Right.
Yeah.
Their way of investing is very different from where we are today.
Yeah, they were pre-internet and they're now in a post-internet world, and they've done fantastically well. I'm not taking anything away from them. And I think you and I were chatting, my analogy, which I'll share here, pretty proud of this one. It was that, you know, Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are now Michael Jordan in the Wizards. Right. Still a great player. Don't get me wrong. But like the heydays, I think, are really behind them.
Mm-hmm.
I think the game that they grew up playing is very different than the game that they are in now. Somebody that I look more to is like Chamath and Kathy Wood.
And me as well. Yeah.
Well, of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. How to lose money.
I think it's a little much that you put my painting up in oil on your wall. But, you know, I'm okay with it. We're friends. We're close.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. That's just. I have a chestless Manish over my bed.
Chestless.
Or sorry, shirtless. Oh, bad. Yeah.
No, but I take your point, and we talked about this before, is that, like, I don't think it's fair to say that their era is over. Like, let me take a step back. I think it's more fair to say, like, when you look at what they do, and this is the first point sort of on the agenda, is that they define a core competency of what they like to see in a business, right? They talk about having a circle of competence, businesses that they can understand, right? And these are typically, I mean, they understand financial businesses very well. They understand consumer businesses very well. And these are typically not, you know, not heavy tech businesses, right? These are businesses that are not easily disrupted by technology, which they've often said they don't understand. They don't really understand tech. And so it's not an area they really play in, although one of their biggest holdings is Apple. But, you know, like you were talking about earlier, they invested in Apple once it was a, you know, multi-hundred billion dollar company.
Was already paying dividends.
And they... it might have been right before that, but yeah, potentially. But more importantly, it was in a position to pay dividends because of all the money it was making. So it had shifted from being like a speculative tech company to really being a dominant, stable CPG type of company, which is a similar transition to what we're seeing right now in cannabis.
What we're seeing in cannabis is we're seeing it going from a purely speculative market where it's all event and hype driven and based off of the tell me story to now the show me story. What have you done? How much money are you bringing in?
Right.
Can we have a more clear path to revenue for most of the names that we look at? And it's easier to quantify. Right. And then you can justify your valuations. And then, you know, when the price dips, you at least know that, hey, there's a real business here. There's actual revenue coming in. Worst case scenario, the stock might be worth, you know, whatever. Pick a number just in this hypothetical situation. As long as the price is still higher, then you should be buying it.
Well, and the point too there is that, like, in the early days when there is no underlying business, when it's all just promise, right, of what is to come, the stock is very important, and the company's ability to keep that stock price up is very, very important because there's no cash flow to the business. The business only burns. So if they cannot, you know, keep their investors interested and keep the hype and keep the price elevated, you know, they're going to have to keep raising capital at lower numbers. Right. So it's very, the IR is so important
early on
in those early stages of the industry. And if the industry as a whole is not very good at raising capital, it's going to really be tough in a capital intensive industry. So I will always give Bruce Linton a world of credit because without him, we would not be where we are today. Right. His ability to excite, to, you know, pound the table, legitimize, bring Canopy to the, you know, to the big boards. Right. He was the first one to do that. And it was a fight. It was not easy. You know, his ability to do all these things opened the floodgates of capital. It's also, in my opinion, part of mostly what ruined the Canadian markets. And unfortunately, the era of overpromise, underdeliver, right, that really left a big stain on the industry. But without that capital coming in, we never would be where we are today in the U.S. because billions of dollars have gone in to funding the U.S. opportunity. It's very hard to get capital in the U.S., but it would have been infinitely harder if Bruce hadn't paved the way. So you have to give him credit for that.
No, I think that he took cannabis and made it like a mainstream topic, right? Everybody was talking about it. It wasn't like a niche market anymore. It became sort of the mainstream. Everybody was everywhere you looked. It was making headlines. People are coming in. There's a lot of promise that was going on. And with cannabis, you also had, I still remember the Canopy story a little bit, and it was like Tokyo Smoke, that acquisition, the Tweed acquisition. They had a cool ticker. It was Weed. I would say the best thing that he did was he legitimized the industry.
I think at one point, like, more Canadians were buying cannabis stocks or talking about cannabis stocks than actually smoking cannabis.
Oh, for sure.
That's how big it got, right? And to this day, like,
I still think that's true though. The Canadian cannabis market is what, $3.5-4 billion in 2019?
2020, in case you're keeping track, it was 2.6 billion. So a little shy of the 3 billion that you thought. But it's the run rate exiting the year is about 3.6 billion.
That's still like, I guess we're not talking black market sales.
Yeah.
If you look at just sales, that's still lower than what the actual capital markets are valued at from a market cap perspective.
Yeah, but that's going to happen every year. That's actually money coming out of people's pockets. Like,
Right,
they didn't raise 3.6 billion this year. You know what I mean? But people spent 3.6 billion. So, And to this day, I mean, you probably see this more than I do. If you talk to Canadians about cannabis, like cannabis investing, there's still a lot of bitterness about like how much money was lost, you know, on the Auroras of the world.
Yeah.
Right. So it's interesting to see that's in Canada, it's a little bit still tapped. Like, people don't really want to dive back in even to the U.S. story. Right. Because they're just like, I'm done with that. right? But sorry, getting onto the point here is that the one of the core ways of being defensive, right, and how to keep the money in your jeans is to build this core competency and then execute around it. Now, this is going to be a little bit difficult because when you're starting out, you don't have a core competency, right? I mean, you're brand new, but that's okay. The key is, and you know, while you're building that core competency, you want to manage your risk. So, you know, if you're new to investing, you're new to this entire world, you don't start out by putting all of your money into the market, mm-hmm. right? Like that would be a giant mistake. Like what you want to do is start small. And you want to, you know, I believe, like for me, I only learn if I have money in the game. If I have skin in the game, that's where I really learn. So start with a much smaller amount of cash that you're willing to, you know, play with, essentially. And it really has to be something you're comfortable losing. And start building your knowledge base. Start building your edge, which then you can exploit later on.
Right. And I always say, and I think you're trying about this, and I always say, if you're going to enter a position, let's say if you want to put $5,000 into it, start with maybe $1,500. You know, don't put the full, don't deploy the full $5,000 right away.
Sure. And I mean, take a step further. If you look, you know, a lot of people will do this. It's like they have a dollar in their bank account, right? Like that's all their investment money. And they'll be like, okay. And they'll go sort of like, they get really excited and they'll invest that full dollar right away. Mm-hmm. But like, that's all your investment money. Like that's not a good idea.
No, it's terrible. Right?
I mean, now it depends. If that's amount of money you generate, you know, every week or every month in your paycheck, fine, right? Then you can replenish that. Mm-hmm. But for most people, they have a nest egg saved up, and that's a decent, like to them, that's a significant amount of money,
right?
But so at the beginning, if you don't have a core competency in this, you really have to take your time. But the beauty of the stock market is that, you know, whether you invest $1,000 or $100,000, it's the same game you're playing, right? You're trying to find a good ticker, a good story, a good company to invest in at the right price. Now, obviously, as the dollar amount changes, liquidity changes, commissions, I get it. That's different.
Yeah.
But the point is, the skill you're trying to build is the same skill, right? Like to me, the hardest part about getting started in investing is getting started, right? Like opening an account, getting the money in, figuring out like, what do you buy? When do you buy it? What are the values? How to buy it, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, so you don't need to start with all of your money. In fact, that's a pretty easy way to lose money.
For sure. It's a terrible way to lose money. And to this point, actually, I was talking to somebody today who's getting interested in investing, and they were looking to buy a cannabis stock in the CSE. And they were like, well, it won't let me buy at market. And that's something I haven't even thought about in forever. When you're buying a stock in the CSE, you can't buy at market. You have to buy at limit. You put a limit order and either hit the bid or the ask.
Okay.
If you go to buy at the market, whereas if you buy something on the NASDAQ, you can just hit market and it'll just fill your order at market price. Can't do that with the CSE.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, try it.
I only ever use limit, so.
Yeah.
I don't trust the market. I don't trust it.
There you go. But try it. It'll just decline your order. And he's like, I don't know why that's not working. And I was like, I don't know. Like, you might have to call tech support or whatever. And then I'm like, can you send me a screenshot of what you're working with? And so he sent it to me. I was like, oh, you're trying to buy at market. You have to like limit a bid or an ask. I don't know if you're buying or selling at whatever he was doing. But it's just something like that.
Yeah.
It was a very new investor. And for a lot of people, you know, they might not have a resource to go to. They might just be like, oh, I don't know how this works. Then they have to call Questrade or TD brokerage house and 2-hour wait. You might just not do it.
Yeah. Forget it. Right. Yeah. This is actually funny. You mentioned this actually happened to me, twice in the last month. One was I was trying to buy an OTC, US stock that doesn't have a Canadian ticker, and it would not let me buy it in my registered accounts, which is like a tax-free account in Canada, right? But you basically, if there's a US only OTC ticker, you have to buy it in a regular account.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, right? I called them and I was like, what is this? And they explained it to me. I was like, okay, cool. And the second one was I was trying to buy Trulieve on the OTC in a registered account, and it kept getting rejected. And so I've owned Trulieve, you know, many times in my life, but I've always owned it on the Canadian side, never owned on the OTC side. Mm-hmm. And I called and they said, oh, you have to use a market maker. Like you have to basically, instead of use auto, there's like a feature that says managed, which sends it to a market maker.
Really?
Again, like.
Was this your Questrade?
Yeah. Like little weird things, but to your point, these are like little esoteric things that like you literally just don't know when you get started. Right. So the point is like when you're getting started, start out smaller, right? Yeah. And what you want to do is you want to build your financial and business IQ. Mm-hmm. So the financial part we've talked about many times, starting to read financials. The business IQ, this is something somebody taught me when I was getting started in real estate, right? He said, look, when you're getting started, like there's a couple of different things you need to build. And one of them is you need to build your real estate IQ. And what that means is that, you know, when you go and visit an industrial building, you need to be able to tell me, you know, is this a good building, at what price, and why or why not?
That's very well said. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's just so simple, right? But yeah. It's like, you know, you kind of go, well, how do I learn these things? Well, you go, well, okay. First of all, you read, you talk to people, you go visit the buildings.
Yeah.
Right. And you try to figure out, like, why is this a good building or why isn't this a good building? Right. What makes it a good building? Right. Like, so for example, in industrial, like, obviously we understand things like location, obviously matter, but industrial, there's things like clear height. So how high the building goes. Right. So if you have a building that's 12 feet tall, that's only useful for like manufacturing or certain kinds of uses. If you want to do warehousing, which is like the hot industry right now, like logistics and shipping, you're better off with higher clear height because you can stack things higher, right? So the cubic feet of height you get actually is a lot more utility for that user,
right?
These are little like
and so what were, if you were to start in real estate? Now this is more about cannabis, but this will tie back into cannabis. If you're starting real estate, how did you learn that? Was that based off of did somebody give you, hey, here's the rules and regulations for real estate investing?
No, because like most things, like most of these kind of niche things in business, like they're not really written down somewhere. Or maybe it is, but it's very hard to find.
No, well, that's why you go to school, right? You go to business school and they try to teach you these ideas top down, bottom up.
They don't teach me how clear height in business school, right? Like, but
no, they wouldn't. But if you went to a very real estate specific school, they probably would. I would think so.
Yeah, maybe. But the point is, like, to answer your point, it's talking to people.
Right.
Right. It's talking to people in the industry. It's networking with people and, you know, talking to people who did industrial deals and saying, hey, why did you buy that building?
Yeah.
What was interesting about that building to you?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if, you know, maybe a silly investor would say, oh, I like, you know, the color of the brick on the outside. Right. But somebody who speaks in functionality, right, actually talking about this and this and this. And the best people to talk to in this industry was the brokers.
Right.
A lot of the brokers would tell you, well, this is why this will be a hard deal. This is why. And it's not to say that anybody has the right answer, but they have a way of looking at the world, mm-hmm. right? Similar to this conversation. You have a way of looking at the world and I have a way of looking at the world. And there's not one right or wrong answer, right? I mean, there is because I'm right and you're wrong, but,
right.
But in reality, like there's money to be made where Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are right, but also Elon Musk is right and Cathie Wood is right.
Right.
But there's enough.
Well, it's like, you know, I always like to draw in the sports analogy, and basketball is a great example of this is, you know, Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett playing like the 96-97 Bulls. It's more of an interior game or an inside game, sorry. And you got Cathie Wood and Elon coming out just shooting three-pointers like Steph Curry does, Warriors, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, turned into a perimeter game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who do you think would win? You think 2015, 2016 Warriors or
Bulls,
97?
Yeah,
right?
But similar to that analogy, there's no comparison. You're never going to be able to take.
I don't know, man. I don't think you played NBA 2020.
you're never going to be able to take their investing record, track record, and match it up against Warren Buffett's because different worlds, different times, different risk profiles, different things.
Exactly.
Right. The key point is, and this goes into the second point, is that you have to learn from a mentality standpoint acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You don't need to make every penny to earn a really healthy rate of return. Right. This is something I think that coming from the real estate world, it surprises me about the stock market world
mm-hmm.
is that people, when they look at these charts on screens, and I've done this too, they get this pit in their stomach if they don't capture every penny.
Yes. And I man, that drives me insane. And I've done so many deals and I think I've mastered that.
Okay.
I know I am not going to catch the top and I know I'm not going to catch the bottom unless if I'm selling at the top or buying at the bottom.
Right.
You or no, wait, no, vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I want to do. But what I actually end up doing is I buy at the top and I sell at the bottom. That's the only time that's ever going to happen. And anybody who's listening, you're not going to catch the top. You really aren't. If you do catch the top, you're lucky. That's it. And unless if you're a very skilled trader, but most of us aren't, right? Mm-hmm. I really think that, again, You got to learn how to, you got to learn how to like buy and sell.
So it's a great point. Actually, you were the one who said this to me a while ago, is that retail are the only people who can buy something for a dollar, then it goes to $2 and they sell, and then it goes to $3 and they get mad at you. Like,
yeah.
Like, why did you tell me to sell? You know?
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing because, you know, from a, this is the next point, from a understanding, like a broader lens of investment, that is a big difference between, you know, successful kind of more seasoned investors versus novice, you know, more speculative investors. Is that
right?
A speculative investor is like playing the lottery.
For sure.
They want to double, triple, quadruple their money quickly.
For right? sure.
In the real estate world, I mean, these guys buying industrial properties, they're getting a 4-5% yield. Then with leverage, they're getting maybe a 7 or 8% yield,
mm-hmm.
right? And then longer term, they're banking on appreciation,
mm-hmm.
right? But 7 or 8%, you know, over
they're also working with larger amounts of capital.
Oh, for sure, it's a different right. game. No question. Yeah. I'm just saying, like these people who are sophisticated investors, they're looking at 7 to 8%, and then maybe if the market really heats up, they get double digit returns.
Right.
Right. And but if you look at how you know the rule of 72 is basically, you know, if you take 7 and, you know, into 72, it's 10. So that means mm-hmm. in 10 years, you can double your money. Like that's just an easy way to figure out kind of compound.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking at doubling their money over maybe 7 or 10 years,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas the new person showing up says, I want to double my money tomorrow.
Right.
Right. Well, like, okay. Like that's actually, you know, going to this point, like that there actually is a game you can play where you go, hey, I want really high yielding investments that will, you know, have the can be multi-baggers quickly. Yeah.
It's called roulette.
that
and it's the casino floor of the Plagio.
Is like if yeah. that's your strategy, like I've always said this, like you have to know what game you're playing.
Yeah.
If the game you're playing is multi-bagger, super high yield, there's a very good chance you're also going to go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that, like this goes to your penny stock comment, right? Which is kind of generically, penny stocks can go way up, but they can also go to zero.
They will go to zero. So yes, sell them
depending on
up.
What they are, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, that's just anecdotally speaking, obviously, it's, sure. it's a joke.
Right, of course. But the point is that, like, we're kind of jumping around here, but going to this idea of acceptance, I think this is so critical. Is like, if you, like, when you look at these cannabis stocks, and I think, by the way, this is a phenomenal time to be in this industry. We did an episode last year called The Golden Age of Cannabis Investing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do another one at some point called The Golden Age of Cannabis Investing, you know, continues or part two. And that is
the
that
Golden-er age.
No, not golden-er, but still in this yeah. age of the golden age, right? And people, it's funny how people interpret that. They see the stocks go up and they go, oh, well, that was the golden age.
Mm-hmm.
And what they don't understand is like, no, it's the ability to invest in an industry which has flipped, it has inflected from purely speculative
mm-hmm.
to real cash flowing businesses
mm-hmm.
or companies that are getting close to that point. You can see like that change on the horizon. And yet the institutional capital, which appreciates all that stuff, is still yeah. boxed out.
And you know what the beauty of this age or this time era that we're in, we're seeing declining prices on the backdrop of improving fundamentals.
Absolutely.
Okay? So let me repeat that for a lot of people who don't understand. Prices are falling, but the businesses are getting better,
mm-hmm.
which may, and you're probably like, wait, that makes no sense. Exactly. Exactly. That's why when Misha's like, we're still in the golden age. We are still in the golden age. If anything, I think this is a better time than we were a year ago. Especially if you're looking at some of the top names. And if you're trying to mitigate some risk, you've got a lot more to work with now. You got a lot more meat on the bone
mm-hmm.
and you can actually go through and not only just you don't have to be sold a story anymore, right? Like, for instance, we always talk about limited license states and investing in those. If you invest in a limited license states, you know the reasons why you want to be in there. One of the great reasons is if you're one of the license holders and the state forecasts certain appreciation, your chances of participating in that appreciation are significantly higher than if you invest in, say, California, where it's an unlimited license state, where new incumbents yeah. come in and they could sort of take away from those sure. gains, right? You can't really do that right now in any other sector. This is like the only sector where you've got businesses that are putting out, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter that are being valued pretty fairly, and their prices are declining, but their earnings quarter after quarter are going up.
Right. And, you know, just go back to your point on limited license states. Like what I always say is, you know, for a company to do 30% EBITDA margins in California is exceptional. Mm-hmm. Really, really good.
Yeah.
Right. You have to be a top operator, you know, great, whatever it is, whatever you're doing, you got to be really good at it and probably have scale. In Florida, you have to like fall over yourself to not hit 30%.
Yeah.
Right. Like even companies that are not that great, that are, you know, a bit of a hot mess, mm-hmm. can still earn that because of the way the program is structured.
Right.
Right. So that's the differentiator, is like, going back to Warren Buffett, you say, if you want to be a great businessman, buy great businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So his point was, rather than go slug it out in the hardest possible business, like there's no points for hitting the trick shot in investing. No. Right. The, it's an easier business is typically just better to invest in.
For sure.
It's just the easiest way to look at it. So
for sure.
Going back to these points here, you know, in terms of building a core competency, there was a lot of things that I really had to improve when I got into this game. Sort of, you know, when I started in 17, I started small, right? I started by kind of, you know, what for me was a decent amount of money, but was still enough that if I lost it all, it would have hurt, but, you know, it wouldn't have been the end of the world for me.
Right.
Right. And then in 19, you know, once I'd made all this money off of MediPharm and the original, you know, round of investments, then I came and said, okay, now I really want to, you know, take a bigger swing at this, right?
Yeah.
But even then, I didn't come in and go, okay, let's put the whole net worth into this. There was really the idea that I'm going to put X percentage of my money in,
mm-hmm.
and in that, I'm going to cut that up into smaller deals, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm really going to try to do, you know, the smallest possible check size I can do, but I'm going to try to do a lot of deals, right, over the next 1 to 2 years,
yeah.
and get an understanding of the lay of the land and build the core competency, right? And one of the things, you know, that I had to learn, and it took me, you know, what was a serious weakness in my game, was just learning about the stock market,
mm-hmm.
right? Learning about these junior stocks, because I was really obsessed with this idea of valuation, right? You value a company, if the company's, you know, if you're investing in a company and they give you a really good valuation, that to me was really compelling. Like it was hard often to say no to that, right? But then what you learn later on is all these other factors. Like, okay, well, what's the structure of the cap table,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, okay, they're giving a great valuation today, but like how much more money are they going to need to raise in the future? When yeah. are we going to get a liquidity event, right? And then if it is a public company, like what about the technicals, right? And I'm not a technical analyst by any means, but now I have a much greater respect for the fact that technicals move the stock in the short term.
They do, yeah.
Right? And understanding momentum,
mm-hmm.
right? And that these are all important parts of understanding the story.
For sure.
And I don't, sorry, just to close the point, I don't ever think that, like, taking a look at myself, you know, figuring out what you're good at and exploiting it. So what I realized is that, look, I'm good at understanding these kind of cash flowing businesses and then figuring out, you know, I find I can make a lot of money at the inflection point. Digging into a company and saying, hey, this company's here right now in Q3, but by, you know, if I look forward, you know, 2 quarters or 4 quarters or whatever, I think it's going to be here and it's going to get re-rated upwards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think I'm pretty good at finding those and then stomaching the volatility up and down
for the short term. Right. Yep.
But where I'm not good at is, you know, necessarily picking the best technical or momentum or whatever stock,
mm-hmm.
bringing it home to acceptance. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't have to make money on Tilray Aphria because, you know, Weed Stocks or Wall Street Bets bid it up.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to see that take off and say, congratulations to everybody who made money on that. That wasn't my game. I'm worried about these things instead.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's, you know, you hit it on the head with the names that you just said. If those names are up, whatever, 4 or 5x or even double in one day, take your profits, right? One story that I just want to kind of go on about goal setting that we were chatting on, a friend of mine gave me a stock tip, something that he was investing in. He's a tech guy, so he invests in his stock called MVIS. They do semiconductors. I know nothing about the company, absolutely nothing. And so he was like, hey, listen, I'm buying this quite heavily. You should take a look at it. I was like, all right, I'll throw some money in, you know? And the stock was, I think, like $11.50 when I bought it. And they were waiting for some Microsoft contract, which they hit. There's a couple, he told me a couple events that were going to be catalysts that will help the stock get re-rated upwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then they sort of took place and the stock went up and he's like, oh, like, have you sold yet? I'm like, yeah, I sold. And he's like, what price did you get out at? I'm like, oh, I got out at about $26. And I'm like, thanks for the tip. And I'm like, what did you get out at? 'Cause he went to 29. He's like, no, I'm still holding. It's back down. And I was like, why wouldn't you sell? And he's like, no, this thing's going to go to $40. Mm-hmm. And I was like, look, it could definitely go to $40. But what I've learned from cannabis investing and small cap investing in general, if you're yelling, you should be selling, first mm-hmm. of all. If you see volume start increasing, the events that you were expecting are up and coming, mm-hmm. and the price is getting re-rated up really high, just take the profits. Take the profits on that day, or leave some of it in if you really want to catch the top, right? And he called me and he was like, oh, wow, you're out of all the guys that I told us, you're the only one who sold. Mm-hmm. And I know all the other buddies who invested, mm-hmm. who we all invest together. And these are the guys that call me when they're like, oh, no, why would I sell at $2 and then get mad when the stock goes to $3, mm-hmm. right? And so I was trying to explain to the whole thing that this is not, this retail theme is not exclusive to just cannabis investing. Totally. It's like retail theme is just across the board.
People are people.
People are people. Mm-hmm. Very well put.
It's
but anyways.
It's more pronounced in our sector because retail has an outsized influence.
Yeah.
Right? Because we don't have that institutional capital, or it's very limited, right? We get these crazy gyrations because it's more retail driven. Mm-hmm. Right? So we feel it more, let's say, than, you know, the tech sector does.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you have people writing multi-billion dollar checks, mm-hmm. and institutions holding the paper really long, it kind of smooths out some of the volatility. Not all of it, but some of it. Mm-hmm. Right? They don't have the same swings we do.
I mean, they do, but not to the extent.
Yeah, I think ours is more pronounced. Like, we have these.
I think ours is more pronounced from a sector perspective. Theirs is more pronounced from like an isolated perspective. Like, if you look at MVIS, that stock is literally, it'll remind you of like cannabis.
Right. Okay.
It's like whipsawed, but tech hasn't whipsawed as much.
Right. Right. It would be really rare for that to happen the way
Very
we go.
Rare.
Like,
yeah.
Right. We shoot up and down. Right. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. so going, going back to what you just said, though, about your friends, right? There's that, like, to me, the big thing about acceptance is understanding that, like, just because you can look at a chart and see the top and see the bottom, like, it is every, I think, novice investor looks at that and says, oh my God, hey, if you bought at 11 and you sold at 27 and then you bought it back at 15, they start doing the math and they're like, oh my God, you'd make so much money doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
what they don't do is, if I bought at 29, I sold at 15, and I bought back at this time, that's the real math. And that's what you should be doing.
So that, like, look, a core part of what we're talking about today is that the way you learn all this stuff, by the way, is through experience.
For sure.
And, you know, we can tell you, Abby can tell you, Warren Buffett can tell you, but the only way I've seen it actually stick is by doing it again and again. And trust me, I had to learn these lessons not once, but multiple times.
Yeah.
And you know, when things were getting kind of soft a couple of weeks ago, I you know, we did the Back to the Future episode, and you know, the point of that, as I've tried to get across, is that, like, you know, part of the reason I have the confidence I do today is because I've been through the ups and downs, and specifically in cannabis. I mean, I've been through the era of you know, oh my God, okay, I'm going to get started slowly, to then all my money's in, to then, you know, seeing the sector melt down, saying, oh my God, some of these companies are about to go bankrupt, mm-hmm. right? This is only a year and change ago, right? And then the market completely melting down and then coming back with a vengeance, mm-hmm. you know, COVID, post-COVID, but then also seeing the businesses pick up, mm-hmm. right? And that was the key thing, being like, wow, COVID really accelerated cannabis and a bunch of these companies are now profitable, right? That was a big inflection point. But what that did is it also gave me a lot of confidence in terms of, hey, going forward, we don't have to worry about a lot of stuff that we had to worry about, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have to ask, you know, can you actually make money selling cannabis in, you know, Illinois or Pennsylvania? Clearly you can.
For sure.
Right? Clearly the margins are phenomenal.
Yeah.
We can see who the good operators are, and now they're replicating that business model in multiple states.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So these are all really positive things. But the key part is, like, going back to acceptance, I mean, it's funny. I mentioned I was adding GTI a lot on the dips, mm-hmm. and I was adding up all the shares because I have different accounts. And the amount of shares that I have of GTI is almost at the amount that I sold right at the pandemic, like when the pandemic started, but at 3.5 times the price. So I bought back, you know, I'm like, oh, look how smart I am. I bought back the dip, right?
Yeah.
But I bought back not even the same amount that I sold, 3.5 times, right? But
it was a different time back then, right?
Yeah. All I'm saying is that, you know, part of the acceptance is that I lived through both sides of it. I owned these stocks and watched them go down, 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 down. I lived through the pain of that. Mm-hmm. I know the pain of the loss. Then I sold, and then I watched all of the names. Everyone suddenly loved these names, and they go up, 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 up. And their business fundamentals actually get better.
Yeah.
And if you sell something and you watch it go up, like your friend selling a 2 and it goes to 3, mm-hmm. there's a real pain in that.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
For sure.
So then you kind of ask yourself, what pain do you want to live with? Mm-hmm. Do you want to live with the pain of holding when it's down? Or do you want to live with the pain of selling and it goes up?
Right. You got to pick one.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's very well put. Yeah. Very well put.
That was the realization for me mm-hmm. is like, look, I'm not going to time this perfectly. And by the way, it's okay to think you are, but if you're mm-hmm. doing that, you better be investing and sharpening your technical analysis skills like every day, right? You better be a wizard at technical analysis if that's your strategy.
I mean, look, you don't even have to be a wizard at technical analysis.
If you're trying to catch the ups and downs?
Well, okay, look, listen, there's some general rules of thumb, and I always say that if volume is going up and the price like skyrockets up, that's a good indicator to start selling. It could continue to go up, but a great one is one of the trades that you and I did with SOL Global, mm-hmm. right? There was a big announcement, mm-hmm. Verano going public. That happened. Stock ran up the day before, and then it pulled back down. Mm-hmm. I put in stop losses at this at certain prices. I can't remember what they were now. But that's because I started seeing volume go up, 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 and then I put them in. And you know, it did pull back, and it hasn't recovered to that level since. I started buying back in, mm-hmm. But I wasn't charting that stock the entire time.
Right, but you're not a technical guy.
I'm not. Well, I mean,
right? you're more of an event driven guy
for sure.
Different things.
Yeah.
Right. Because technical is to view.
I don't look at candlestick charts. I don't
exactly.
I don't look right? at Mac. Yeah.
You're looking overall for the thesis of what's going to move this stock. What's mm-hmm. going to get people excited and bring eyeballs to the stock. Right? Yeah. Very different from a technical person who just says I like the chart.
Yeah.
Right. But again, these are all pieces of the puzzle which you put together. Mm-hmm. It's not so isolated. But talk for a second about those stop losses, because I've never used a stop loss, right? You use them frequently.
I use them in every trade. Always say when I enter a trade, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but whenever I enter a trade, I know my exit price, okay? And the exit price isn't one number. It's two numbers, actually, okay? The first one is if the stock dips, this is just general rule of thumb. If I enter a stock at a dollar, if the stock dips below 30 or 40%, I typically just bail and say it's a bad investment if I know nothing about the company, right? So if I, let's say I invest in ABC Corp, I know literally nothing about it. I buy into it, it's a dollar. I'll put in a stop loss about 70 cents.
Okay.
Okay. I'll watch it, obviously. I still watch the story. I start reading up on it. And if the stock dips closer and closer to the 70 cents, then, you know, I can move the stop loss or I can come in and do some more research and say, okay, this is actually going down.
But so just take a step back. Why are you typically investing in ABC company that you don't know that much about, right? It's more of a speculative play, but mm-hmm. what usually compels you to decide to make the buy?
That's a great question. It's usually in a sector
uh-huh.
that's growing.
Right.
So
what I mean specifically is, do you get to the name by using the Ouija board or the Magic 8 Ball?
Well, you know, It's a little from column A, a little from column B. You got to use both, right? It's
Magic
like, you know,
people can't really help you, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, it can. It's like, should I buy? The outlook looks uncertain.
Let's try again.
Ouija board. I mean, the Ouija board, you know, that's the best
way to do that. Your ancestors channeling.
Yeah, know. Exactly. It's like, how do you think I got the ticker? You know? I have a stop loss in like if it pulls back by 30-40%, and that's because look, I do have a demanding job where I can't sit in front of the computer all day,
right?
Even though I work in finance, I take a lot of meetings and I can't be in front of it, and I don't trade on my cell phone, so that's why I have that. It's like an insurance policy.
Yeah,
right.
That's risk mitigation.
Yeah, that's the, because look, listen, I've been in names that have gone down 40-50%, mm-hmm. or sorry, 50-60%, and it's like, you know how hard it is to get back from 60%? It's the stock has a double.
Yeah, or more.
More. It has to go more than that.
It goes from a dollar to 40 cents, it has to go 2.5x.
Yeah, and that's tough to do.
Right.
And I've lived through that a couple of times, so I don't want to see that anymore.
Right.
So I've chosen 30% or 40% as the number, depending on how much I know about the sector and how much I don't. And the other one is just an exit price that I have going in. I don't put a limit order on this. I just say, okay, if I got mentally, in a dollar, mentally, when it hits $2, I'm selling half, right? That's what it is. Irrespective of what happens, double sell half, right? There you go.
Listens.
Yeah. If you're yelling, should be selling up double, sell half. And so those are the two things that I really do. Right. Right. And then if there are events that are coming, and what I mean by events, like I don't mean like Oshiega or like Veld or Tomorrowland, where I'm going to be pulled away from.
A real local joke.
No. Events are catalysts for the sector. And they may be probably, some people are like, what? That's a catalyst? For example, when I first entered the cannabis industry, uplisting, I didn't realize was going to be as impactful as it was. Mm-hmm. And recently in the psychedelic industry, you had MindMed, which is one of the larger companies in the industry, uplist the NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. And that brought life back into the market. So a lot of my psychedelic names, when I started seeing them go up, I just pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. Because the event hit, the volume was up, I was out. Mm-hmm. Right. And they have pulled back since then. Mm-hmm. That's probably how I do the stop losses. So I have a stop loss target and then like a target for when I enter. Mm-hmm. And then I have an exit strategy for when I leave. And every single trade that I enter, I usually put a stop loss. It's 30 to 40% below and the price.
I like the example you use there of MindMed and the NASDAQ uplisting because, you know, I follow that ticker and I've never owned it, never had any desire to own it, but it's a good gauge of just what's going on. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, MindMed is kind of recognized as one of the leaders, right? Mm-hmm. Again, Bruce Linton, Kevin O'Leary. So a lot of star power there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that brings business power is another question, but certainly a lot of eyeballs come to that thing, right?
Ability to raise capital.
Capital for sure, which is important in this kind of industry, right? So what's interesting to me about that, and because connecting two things you already said, is that the NASDAQ, it said, okay, MindMed is going to be uplisting to the NASDAQ, right? Mm-hmm. And that, like the stock was just on fire. I think it went up 40% or something in a day. Mm-hmm. And the next day it went up even more, right? And it's just like, and you start thinking about it, and this is human nature. You start seeing it run and you go, ooh, well, like how high can it go? Well, I mean, look at the NASDAQ. Things can go to the moon, right?
Yeah.
And yet, the funny thing is, by the time it actually hit the NASDAQ, so much of that juice was already baked in. First, you know, I think, I'm not sure if today was the first day or the second day, but it just has been tanking on the NASDAQ, right? Yeah. So it's the old, like, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news, which, yeah, I don't really subscribe to, but you can see it playing out there. Like another way to think about it is it was just too juiced up, like the too much good was baked into it.
Yeah.
Right. And then what people think, and I've been there before, is you go, okay, well, it's up 50 or 60% and it hasn't even hit the NASDAQ yet. Mm-hmm. So imagine what's going to happen on the first day of the NASDAQ.
Yeah.
Right. But sometimes the opposite happens. Sometimes, in fact, people go, this is the what I've been waiting for.
Yeah, I'm out. Yeah.
Right? And the point is, it's very difficult to predict when that tide will turn.
Oh, it's almost impossible to predict. And
basically,
you know,
impossible.
It is. And even when you talk to the company will always say, oh, it's going to happen, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And sometimes it never happens. In this circumstance, it did happen. Mm-hmm. But there are situations where it doesn't happen.
What's the what?
When it doesn't happen?
The tide turning, you mean?
No, like the event that you're waiting
uplisting.
For.
Right, okay.
Right. The event, in this case, it was uplisting, but there are certain events that I'm still waiting for to occur. It's been like years.
What's that?
For cannabis.
What's the event?
Well, Europe being the startup that it's supposed to be, that's one of them.
Anything happening in Europe, yeah.
Colombia, like what happened to that
Mexico
story?
Mexico just delayed legalization.
So it's like
these, their deadline, yeah.
So now you see when you're investing in a speculative industry that doesn't have...
That's a great point. You're making a great point here.
I usually do if you listen. No, if you tune in once in a while, you know, what do you think the Ouija board and the 8-ball are for? These delays that occur, and they often do occur, are going to impact these returns that you have. So when you see all these, when you have all this hype and you start investing in event-driven stocks, know that there's a high possibility that event doesn't occur.
Right. Or even by the time that event occurs, mm-hmm, maybe it's already, like the upside's already been baked in.
Yeah.
Right. Like you might not, and this is a really, for me, again, a big realization was that you can very accurately predict what's going to happen, mm-hmm, in the world, like the events and how they're going to unfold. Like, oh, I think this company will have a great Q1. Mm-hmm. But you cannot predict how the market will react to it.
Right.
And that's where, and to some degree, I've kind of stopped trying. Like, I'll give you an example of a recent trade that we've talked about, which is Harvest. And Harvest is a name that everybody you mention it to is like, yuck. Like, mm-hmm, come on, we've heard this name before. It's not new. It's not sexy.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of just left for dead.
Yeah.
But when you actually look at the company, you go, well, actually did a lot of cleanup last year And really, the event-driven catalyst, to your point, is to me a financial catalyst, which comes into where what I like, which is Arizona. Mm-hmm. Right? Everyone's looking at the Northeast. Meanwhile, Arizona quietly flipped to rec and didn't issue any new retail licenses.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have an accelerating, not even accelerating, like overnight, you know, a huge growth. Now, is that growth 40%, 50%, 80%? Nobody knows yet.
But because Arizona's a limited license state and they're one of the license holders, mm-hmm. that gave you more clarity into what the revenue could possibly be.
Well, I mean, here's the best part. They pre-announced their Q1 and their Q4, but nobody's paying attention.
Right.
So they did like $70 million in Q4. They pre-announced just under 90. Mm-hmm. I think they're being a little conservative. Like, I think they'll hit basically 90.
Yeah.
That's 30% quarter over quarter growth. Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to be a really strong Q1, mm-hmm. right? I don't know that any other large MSO is going to have that kind of growth. And I bet you that will probably continue into the back half of the year because, you know, Arizona only went kind of in February. So they're getting, you know, that's not even a full quarter they're getting there, right? That, mm-hmm. that pop, right? Mm-hmm. Also, they're the largest retailer in Arizona.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, I don't need to know exactly how much money they're going to make to know. I think they have a really good year, right?
Right.
But so that's event driven, to your yeah. point. But then to my, like how I like it is that it's sort of a value play. I mean,
well, I'll tell you why that's a little bit different than most event driven sure. strategies. That event occurred and nobody paid attention to it. And that's why you like it. Whereas and you didn't invest pre legalization.
Totally. Yes. Very true.
Right. Because if you had invested pre legalization for Arizona flipping, mm-hmm. you would have then been delayed.
Well, and if you see actually the stock chart, like before Arizona flipped, Harvest was kind of soft, flipped, as in like passed it at the ballot. And then with everything else, Harvest really ran.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I was looking at it, it got too expensive for me.
Yeah.
So I was like, forget it. Who cares? And then with this cool off, Harvest comes back.
Yeah.
And the beauty of these unloved names, like an SOL Global, like a Harvest, like a Liberty Health, to go back to, you know, the old favorites to dust them off.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of times the unloved names, yes, they can get some heat, but they can give it back pretty quickly.
Yep.
Right? Because there are a lot of people like yourself who might be buying it out of interest, but hey, if it goes down 20%, I'm out
no.
of it.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to stick around for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So once it comes back down, that's where I get interested.
Yeah.
So this is going to bring me to sort of the core of my thesis personally, okay? And as you guys are seeing here, like me and Abby, like different ideas, sometimes we come together on the same idea, right? Mm-hmm. Like not always, but... the crux of how I look at stuff is valuation. And that gives me a really good framework of what to buy, when to buy, and when to sell. And this is just the core thesis of how I invest. It comes from, you know, the commercial real estate background. And to give you a quick kind of primer, when I first started in commercial real estate, I was taught very basically it's all about income.
Mm-hmm.
So if the property generates a dollar of net income, then you put a multiplier on it, right? And then a common multiplier could be 20x, like in, wow. in real estate.
That's pretty expensive.
Yeah, and that's like that dollar would be like an EBITDA would be mm-hmm. an EBITDA number. Yep. Then we put like, let's say a 20 multiplier on it. So the property should sell for $20.
Yeah.
And if the property sells for $30, then the person buying it is really silly. And if the property sells for $15, the person got a great deal.
Right.
Buyer, I'm saying, mm-hmm. right? But what I learned a lot from some people is people who would buy a property that was only generating 50 cents and they would pay the $20. That sort of scratched my head and say, or let's say they would buy it for $18. And mm-hmm. I'd scratch my head and say, well, this deal doesn't make sense,
yeah. right?
Based on the multiplier. But what they saw was the ability to turn 50 cents of income to $1.50, right? They basically had the vision of, oh, we can get this property, you know, to fix it up and essentially re-rate it, like yeah. what we talk about, right?
It's a two-bedroom, but you can fit 50 people in that place, you know? You don't need bathrooms, don't worry.
I told you that in confidence.
Slumlord investing.
So seeing that, you know, putting in the sweat equity and essentially, right. you know, like in some cases, it was just turning on the asset, right?
Yeah.
It was obviously it's already running, but, you know, fixing it up and changing the nature of it, totally changing the income profile of it.
For sure.
So I learned... But what I'm getting at is it took me years to see that.
Right. And that's also that specific example that you're using mm-hmm. is you use the term sweat equity, but that's also a competitive advantage mm-hmm. that person who's investing in is adding. They're totally. That's their value add.
Totally.
So for example, if I, let's say me with zero experience in that, mm-hmm. I went in there I wouldn't be able to generate $1.50 in income out of that 50 cents, right? So that they're baking that into consideration.
Right. And if you want to, again, use this analogy to the stock market, that is your entrepreneur. That is the team you're betting on.
Yeah, your operations guy.
Exactly. Or your CEO, whoever. Like that is your developer. Your developer is essentially the entrepreneur you're betting on, right? That is your horse. The building, again, an analogy, is like the limited license that you're looking at, or the license you're looking at, right? So we're gonna go in California or whatever market, and this is what we're gonna do with it, right? So just completing this analogy that I'm just coming up with on the fly, it's that, you know, if you take a limited license, that's like having a great, like maybe a crappy building in a great location. If you have a downtown building, you know, that's really run down, the entrepreneur can look at it and say, well, if I invest X dollars, I can really turn this into something special.
Right.
Right. And then the difference is, you know, is that asset located in a great area, like, you know, like a Florida license, or in a tough area, like a California license. Right. That's sort of different ways of thinking about it.
For sure. For sure.
But my point is, what I figured out in all of this is that I was not good at tracking the ups and downs, figuring out momentum or figuring out what the next hot thing would be. That was not for me. But what I am good at is figuring out, like reading a balance sheet, reading a cash flow statement, figuring out, you know, obviously figuring out EBITDA and multiples. But then the step beyond that, right, is actually kind of mapping out a company's assets, figuring out in the short to medium term where there's going to be the most uplift or most pop, right? So that comes to harvest. Doesn't take a rocket science to look at that and say Arizona, biggest operator, probably a lot of juice are going to squeeze out of that, right?
Yeah.
It's just what it's interesting to me, and where the secret sauce is valuing the company. So looking at the numbers of shares outstanding, the debt structure, the price it's trading at. And then when you look at it, and you go, oh, maybe at this number, it's a little too expensive, it's not juicy enough yet. If it comes down to this number, then we get interested.
Yeah, exactly. And so you call that intrinsic value.
Intrinsic value, but it's also a range. It's not, you know, you have to have some humility and understand, like, intrinsic value is not like, okay, it's worth $3 a share.
Yeah. No, it's I don't think,
it could be worth between, you know, $2.50 and $3.
And that's, and to you, that's fair value.
Yeah, that's like a band, right? It's a band where you might buy. And then on the flip side, okay, well, how big do I think, how juicy is the opportunity? Well, this. Yeah. And if it doubles, you know, over a year, that's pretty good. So around, you know, this band and this band, I start selling.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So, and so that's really key to, for me. And that's sort of the idea of the value band, right? And that's with Vireo, you know, similar example, but that's an example of sort of momentum driven story potentially with New York, with Minnesota.
Right.
As we get closer to New York legalizing, and as we get more eyeballs in the space, people are going to ask, who are these 10 people in New York? And who is the most leveraged to New York, right? I mean, Vireo has by far the smallest market cap of any of the 10 big companies, maybe there's one private one. But so that becomes, you know, more of a momentum play, right?
Vireo.
Yes, not today, but as eyeballs come back to it, right? That's, I'm kind of betting on over time that will get some love.
Gotcha.
Right. Okay. But there's a value band again, a certain number, it's out or trimmed and move on. Right. But, and the last point I want to make is a weakness that I had to overcome is that I would run around originally doing 100% value. Okay. Like, okay, we need to find things that are undervalued and cheap. But what I learned is that you can have too much value in your portfolio. And really what you want is you want sort of a mix of things.
Okay.
You want exposure to, you know, sort of the green chip names, right? The big five that we've talked about many times.
Yeah.
Because as significant capital comes in, that's where it's going to flow first.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? You want, I'm overweight on the mid caps, right? The people or the names that I think have proven to be good operators, have the right assets, but haven't inflected yet. Right. So my biggest holding is Ascend, and Ascend's actually going public on Tuesday tomorrow, but you know, by the time this comes out, it'll already be public. But names
like... Sounds like public tomorrow.
Tuesday, yeah. On Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
CSE, yeah.
For some reason, I thought it was next month.
No, it's... well, next month. We are next month. yeah, we're here.
That's true.
Future is now, Abby. So the mid-caps, a lot of interest in, but the right mid caps that I think are going to kind of hit that stride and have the scale. And then lastly, that bottom portion of the portfolio is the wacky stuff, the higher leverage stuff, which meaning like the warrants, you know, the little small cap names, you know, the consortiums of the world, not today because I'm selling now, but when I was buying it, right? These all make up bands in the portfolio, portions of the portfolio. And that way I'm, you know, it's all cannabis, but it's exposed to different risks, different risk profiles, and has different return profiles. And in a weird way, it's a bit of risk mitigation because I've got a little bit of everything in there. And it's important for me personally because that way, you know, I'm not going to, a lot of those names I'm not touching, but some of the other ones I might, you know, trade in and out of a little more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying. That makes sense. I mean, I have a couple questions just in terms of how you're coming up with these allocations. Like, you know, how much are you allocating towards the mid caps and how much are you allocating towards large caps?
So,
why did you come up with them?
Yeah. I think we talked about this in a previous episode when we were talking about allocations and whatnot. Right. And it just changes all the time. It depends on the deal and there's,
I don't mean name specific. I mean band specific.
Well, this is what I'm getting at. I don't necessarily sit there and say, okay, I need 30% up here, 40%, and 30% down there. Like, it's not really how I think about it. Okay. What I do is I go, okay, this seems like a pretty good deal. This seems like a good deal at this price. And then even like in the last couple of weeks, as the market has cooled and we've seen like GTI really come down, I started loading up on GTI.
Okay.
So that's an example of like I reallocated towards the top band because that it seemed like a good opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't sit there and say 30%, 40%. And the other thing too is I realized I've been marking all my things at cost. So like when the private company comes public and it goes several X.
Yeah. Suddenly, you're not going to trim down. Yeah.
No, but suddenly the weighting is completely out of whack. Right. Yeah, so now my mid cap, because of Ascend, my mid cap is like huge compared to everything else. Yeah. But it's getting to the point, it's more deal specific.
Right.
It's more looking at like, okay, I think this company will get re-rated. But more simplistically, it's like, hey, I've seen that momentum is important. So let me try to have one or two or three names that I think will get a lot of love on the momentum side. So that's where you get to GTI and Crest.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. No. I get the momentum aspect of it, but I'm saying it's just more or less like, how did you come up with the weighting for the large cast, but it looks like you didn't. It just sort of
it happened.
It just organically occurred.
It just kind of happens. Like it's not to say that you really sit there. It's actually an ongoing question, honestly.
Yeah.
Because you kind of ask, okay, I like this opportunity. How much do I like it? You know, how much money do I have? What am I willing to sell? You know, to do that kind of deal, right? And in my case, I sold a lot of SOL Global to buy GTI. Right. I was up 50, 60, 70%. On you know different points on it, you know I still like the name, I still hold a decent chunk of it, but you know to your point, it was understanding kind of value bands, relative valuation, and I thought, hey, like when this name is holding up pretty well, and I have this green chip name in GTI that's getting pummeled,
let's reallocate. It's time to reallocate. That makes sense. Yeah,
it's real. And if you think about the bands, SOL was kind of in the you know that the wacky next, band, right? Yeah. That bottom wacky band. GTI is in the top band. You know, when the market gave me that opportunity, I reallocated it.
Which makes sense, which definitely makes sense. One other thing. So again, because we've talked about event-driven occurrences quite a bit in this episode. So Ascend is going public. That's going to be another big one. What do you think the next event is after that?
So it's a great question. So I think similar to with Verano, I think people need to get to understand these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you know, back to this idea of core competency, you know, one of my things is that a lot of people like to chase performance of a stock, momentum,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right. They see a stock go up, they figure it's going to keep going up.
Right.
Right. And often, as we've talked about, a stock goes up because of good IR,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think Jushi is a great example of this. Like good company, done a lot of really interesting things. I can't stomach the price. It's not, the price isn't that crazy, but mm-hmm. they have really good IR behind them.
Yeah, and they've got some good assets too.
For sure, and good operators and all that. But like, if you compare, you know, their financial performance to like an Ascend, which is coming out, I think you'll see a very different, it's very stark contrast, let's say.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is Jushi people, you know, Jushi was out for a long time, over a year, and nobody knew who they were. right? And they slowly built trust with investors, and that now gets a premium, mm-hmm. right? So my thinking is that's, you know, Verano and Ascend are not going to be strangers forever.
Right.
People are going to get to, like, Verano's coming out with their Q1. People will get to see now a properly broken out Q1, and they'll get to see the performance of Verano.
Right.
Right. And over a year, that will be very powerful. Yeah. Right. So Ascend, same idea, except with Ascend, a lot of their stores are just coming online.
Yeah.
So they just opened the only downtown adult use dispensary in all of downtown Boston.
Yeah.
Which is insane to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
But that to me is going to be a monster asset.
Yeah.
Similar to they're just opening their store in New Jersey in Paramus.
Yeah, yeah. And that store was like, because, you know, you and I were mm-hmm. chatting about it. And that's a very unique story. And I thought the way that they explained that was really good, where they went and found a location that every single person knew,
mm-hmm.
and they went and converted that into a cannabis store.
Yeah.
They found a landmark. So if you live in Toronto's a pretty big city, but I grew up in a small city. When you grew up in a small city, people don't necessarily use street names all the time. They're like, oh yeah, that's right by the YMCA, or that's by like the mall.
Interesting.
Right. And so this was one of those, like, New Jersey is obviously a massive city, but if you, people there still say, oh, this is by that store.
Right.
That's where this is. And everybody used to point that store, and they're like, that's where we're going to open a store.
Well, I think the story in more detail was that they couldn't find the location they really wanted, right? In I think it's Paramus or Rochelle Park is the area. I think mm-hmm. Rochelle Park is the area. But they went to Staples. They saw that there was a Staples that had, like, you know, the size, the parking, etc. And they called Staples. They called the landlord, and they somehow agreed to move Staples out. And they paid money to do all this, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And they got, you know, what they describe as a phenomenal location.
Yeah.
That wasn't available. Yep. Like, they had to go buy, essentially move people around. And it's also a great story about, yeah. you know, sort of the old world of, you know, Staples being taken over by
a cannabis company,
yeah. right? It's a great little anecdote, but so that's an example of, you know, a really good asset, I think, that will open up. And these things, I have no idea how it's going to perform in the short term.
Yeah.
But I think over 1 to 2 years, I think it's going to do really, really well.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I did the IPO, like, I really thought 10 times about where the value of the company is, the price I'm getting it at. I have a model and just an internal idea of where the value is and where I think it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, where, you know, I trim a little bit, where I buy. Like, these are all things that I've mapped out.
Yeah.
And are very, very core to me mitigating my risk.
Right. Right.
Right.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. Thinking about that. Old world taking over the new world. You think this back to school, like, assuming everything's open again, so people just, like, don't know that this is a cannabis store, right? Because how often do you visit Staples? They just show up and they're like, what?
They take their kid and they go, and all of a sudden, they rebranded Ascend.
Yeah, this is it. Ascend. It's a wellness store.
Yeah, that's a funny point, actually. I hadn't thought of it. So, actually, funny enough, last point here that I have on managing risk, and this is probably the most important thing on not losing money in stupid ways. It's like, don't chase the shiny item. And, you know, as I'm telling you about this new IPO, I'm saying don't, you know, like, a good example is Verano, right? So we talked about Verano many times, very excited for that IPO. I had buy orders in to buy on the first day, but I had buy orders in at $15 and $20 Canadian. The stock opened in like the high 20s or something. Never hit my buy order. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no problem. I canceled them. I just canceled the buy order and I just waited.
Right? Why didn't you just leave them out? Like,
oh, because I have to leave the money there, right? So it's just like, it didn't look like it was going to hit that. It was so far above that, yeah. right? It's like, okay, the stock is trading hotter than, you know, people are valuing it higher than I am, right? No problem. Let it go. And then over time, over a couple of weeks, it came back and it started dipping pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
And people get this thing where they want to own the new thing at any price,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, guys, like, did you read the deck? Did you look at the filings? Like, you know, did you figure out what the intrinsic value is to you? Not saying everybody has to think that way, but that's what allows me to do these kind of things where you go, at this price, I like it. And this band, I like it. And this band is getting too rich for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So IPOs, you know, are they come out scorching hot in a really hot market, right? I think Ascend is coming out in a softer market, so maybe a little bit friendlier, mm-hmm. right? The pricing also came down a little bit, so I think it's a more interesting off the gate, but it depends what the price is. In general, like, the the things that will really kill you in this industry, and just you can throw your money away: hype, promotion, and momentum.
Yeah.
And very true. So hard to resist the urge to put money in when you see other people making money on GameStop or Aphria or Sundial.
Dogecoin.
When you see these things going to the moon and you see people who know nothing making money hand over fist.
Yeah.
Of course you want a piece of that. Right? I mean, you don't think that in mid-Feb when Aurora and Sundial were going to the moon and like the MSOs were languishing, I wasn't like, you know, like, damn, I wish I did a little bit of Canadian LP.
Yeah, of course.
But again, like that, I'm okay with that. You know, like I was like, you know what?
I think that was a last run for the mistaken identity trade.
Maybe. I mean, who knows?
I think so.
You never know, right?
Yeah.
But even then, some of these prices are just, those companies still are too elevated today to even be interesting.
For sure.
Right. But all I'm saying is chasing that after that shiny item and running it up, like you guys have now seen what happens when it goes the other way.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, like, that's being defensive is stopping yourself when you want to do it. Or if you're going to do it, using a much smaller portion than you wanted to.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it goes, it's great. Maybe you just make less money than you thought.
Yeah. Have some exposures. If you want to participate, it's perfectly fine. And I always find that it's easy to say, and a lot of people, when they do try to do that in practice, it becomes the same thing as if the stock is continuing to go up, they don't want to take any risk off. So if it's up, double, sell half, they don't want to sell half their position. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people come back and like, oh, did you actually sell half? I'm like, yes, I sold half. Or sometimes I won't. And I'll sell like 90% or something just to leave a little bit more. Because mm-hmm. I think, because the story's changed a little bit, but I will still take as much as I can off the table mm-hmm. when I can.
But that's the key thing is you learn that from the pain of experience.
Oh, you learn that from the pain of it going up double and going back down to zero, right? Like that's where you really learn it. I've had trades where both my initial investment plus my warrants were in the money. I didn't take a single penny off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not – I don't think they're ever going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So – and I keep those line items. That's one stock that I haven't sold and it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. That's the kind of – yeah, you don't – those help you really learn. Right. And I've done that where I bought something just, oh, this is a good trade or whatever. I don't know the company that well. And then you get crushed on it and you go, I don't know what to do now. So I might as well sell because I don't know, you know, it's going down now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the key here, I think the takeaway is there's different ways to play this game. There's different ways to make money. You know, you need to think about a system. You need to think about downside as well as upside. You need to think about and true both ways, right? When times are good, you think about up and down. When times mm-hmm. are bad, you think about the up and the down.
Yeah.
Right? Like these are always things that should be in your head as an investor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the key part of defensive investing is that, you know, if you can mitigate your losses and not lose big, right? That in itself can really help you get ahead in investing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people take these huge, huge hits or tie their capital up and something which goes down by, you know, 50% and they're scared to go in more, they have to hold it or whatever.
Mm.
It's really, really hard to recover, to your point.
For sure.
Any final thoughts you want to leave people with, Abby?
Yeah. So if you go on Amazon.com, you can get 8-balls for a great price. They're magic 8-balls. No, I mean, listen. And it'll also recommend an item called a Ouija board.
Yeah.
Highly recommend both of them.
Those are all tax write-offs for Abby.
Yeah. Exactly. No, you know what? I think we did a great job covering sort of all the ways to sort of to be defensive in a very volatile, highly cyclical industry. One thing we didn't talk about is market cycles. Market cycles do affect cannabis as well. It's not something that, you know, you can't just be ignorant towards. Like it is something that you should start studying or understand. It's still quite nascent in the sense that, you know, pre-COVID, you and I would chat about, oh, is it going to be a defensive sector where a recession-proof sector, right? But that's just something to keep into consideration. You know, we talked about a lot of stuff. We talked about stop losses, managing risk, not buying like the shiny object or whatnot. But market cycles is also something that people should really take into consideration when trying to get a little bit more defensive. And you know, I can't stress this enough. It's okay to take profits and start taking some when you're up.
And to your point about market cycles, I mean, we've seen some crazy volatility in cannabis when the S&P 500 has been really strong, right? So if the S&P 500 pulls back as part of this broader, you know, market pullback, which could happen easily, what's going to happen to our sector? Sometimes we're correlated, sometimes we're not. But it's hard for me to think that the whole world, you know, the world economy pulls back and we just keep on running, right? So
yeah.
So I think, you know, that's, look, there's just always things you should be thinking about having some kind of game plan for, right? And I think the number one thing I would just say to you is, you know, if you're newer to the space, you know, practice some mitigation in how much money you're using, right?
It's,
it's nice to have cash. I hope that last couple of weeks have taught people that. And, you know, you never know when the opportunities are going to come, right? So
absolutely.
I think that's a good place to leave it off. Thanks, everybody. CINpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.